We're learning about statewide 911 system upgrades here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Nearly a year ago, the state started to work on this report reviewing the current patchwork of 911 systems. And the goal is to build this sophisticated system that can accept text messages and videos and ultimately reduce wait times. So we're getting briefed on what's called next-gen 911. Have you ever called 911? Did you experience any problems that state authorities should know about? How quickly have dispatchers responded to your emergency calls? We're at 800-642-1234 for you to join in. Jessica Jimenez works for the State Office of Emergency Communications in the Department of Military Affairs, and she oversees the Next Generation 911 program. Jessica, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having us here today.
And Molly Boss is here. Molly is a supervisor in the Office of Emergency Communication, works on 911 system upgrades as well. Molly, welcome to you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, Jessica, let's start with this survey that you did. More than 100 agencies across Wisconsin that handle 911 calls. What did you learn as you did the survey about readiness?
Sure. In relation to readiness, when we issued the survey, we did get 108 responses. Based off of that survey results, we've identified potentially 122 public safety answering points within the state where you can contact 911. That includes the federal, state, and local entities that are operating 911 across the state. In particular to the readiness of the 911 centers in particular, we're at about 50%, we believe, readiness for next-gen 911 capabilities. That's to say that their equipment at the 911 center is capable of receiving the data that the statewide network would then translate into their centers. Based on the survey's results, we also asked whether or not they were ready to upgrade their systems within the next 12 to 24 months. Based on those results, we'll be up to about 75% readiness within that time frame, which leaves us about 25% of the way that we need to get there.
Yeah, so you really have some clear data here. Mm-hmm. And when you say PSAPs, you're talking about these public safety answering points or 911 call centers, as,
yep,
as we might know them. When you go around the state and look at these call centers, do they all pretty much have similar infrastructure, or are they all operating on really different platforms out there?
It's actually all very, very different. They go through different service providers, your AT&Ts, your TDSs. They also have different types of equipment vendors. They operate differently just based on their region and where they're operating, how they do mutual aid requests and things like that. So making sure that we understand where each of them are individually is very important when we go in to maintain the service that they're doing now, but then upgrading it to this next-gen 911 system.
And when you say upgrading to next-gen 911, how big of an upgrade is that? Is it going from like analog to digital, or you know?
Yes, that's essentially the transition that we're trying to make into this IP-based network so that we're able to take in those additional data elements that are outside of your traditional voice capabilities. Those text messages and videos, they come with a lot of data that the existing infrastructure is not capable of translating into the 911 center. So replacing their equipment at those locations to make sure that they're capable of receiving that.
We're learning about the state's plans for an upgraded network of 911 call centers. Jessica Jimenez and Molly Boss are here from the State Office of Emergency Communications. And you can join in. How quickly have 911 dispatchers responded to your emergency calls? What have you noticed from your experiences? Do dispatchers seem to have adequate resources? And have you gotten busy signals or had other trouble connecting with the dispatcher? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Molly, take us back a little bit here. What have some agencies already done to get ready for this transition?
Sure. There are several counties in the state that actually have gone forward and purchased the equipment necessary to be able to handle the next generation 911 calls. Those are typically the larger counties who have had the money to spend on the very expensive equipment. There are several counties that have not made that transition yet. So that is also why we are working, and we recently received a federal 911 grant to help those local, the most times smaller counties that can't afford that transition to the more expensive equipment and the upgrade.
We'll get to the grant in a moment, but when you say very expensive, how much money are we talking about to upgrade?
It really can vary. We, as part of the grant, tried to figure that out, but oftentimes it depends on the vendor. I think we are providing an estimate of potentially $27,000 for the federal grant, which also requires a 40% match, and we're expecting that they're probably going to have to match more on the local side. So the federal grant we are receiving probably won't even be enough to cover the transition for all the counties in the state.
Right. They are going to eventually have to put some match money in to be able to make these upgrades. Do counties pass this along to their residents? How, you know, if they can't pay for it out of their budget?
That's a good question. I think each county probably handles it a little bit differently. Unfortunately, we are in a state where we don't have a 911 surcharge, where many other states around the country they do have a 911 surcharge that goes directly to the locals to purchase this kind of equipment. We have the police and fire protection fee in the state here that can go back to the county to be used for this type of investment, but that's not guaranteed.
So, Jessica, Wisconsin has this patchwork, as you say, of 911 call centers. Who typically handles 911 calls in communities?
Typically, they'll be at the county level. There are some city or village, municipality type of 911 centers. A lot of times they'll be under the sheriff's department, police department. We have seen them under emergency management or like a joint services operation where they're all encompassing sort of a consolidated environment. So again, it really varies because, as you said, you know, it's very patchwork across the state. So.
And it even varies where they are housed physically, I would assume, then.
Yeah, some are housed within their jail. A lot of times you'll see, if you have ever walked into a smaller county jail, they'll have a front desk. A lot of times those are the telecommunicators that are answering the 911 calls. They're also feeding the inmates. They're answering administrative calls. So there's a lot of things that the telecommunicators have to do in addition to answering 911 calls.
Huge multitasking in, yes, in those communities, and basically having to keep the phone with them at all times, I would assume.
Yeah.
So, you know, as you go around the state, do you find, Jessica, that communities are wanting this upgrade? Are they behind this?
Based on our survey results and us going around the state and just doing presentations, a lot of the 911 centers are ready. They want to make the transition. They realize that they have to, just because of how the technology works. A lot of it is at end of life and becoming rapidly obsolete. So this replacement and this upgrade is really essential to maintain the existing level of 911 services we have today.
We're talking about state efforts to upgrade emergency call centers. We're talking with Jessica Jimenez and Molly Boss. They're here from the State Office of Emergency Communications, and they're working on the next generation 911 capabilities, or next gen. Are you a 911 dispatcher or a first responder? What do you think people should know about your work? Have you ever tried sending text messages or videos to 911 dispatchers? What happened? Be part of the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this conversation in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the work to upgrade 911 capabilities across the state. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being with us. With this new system, dispatchers will be able to follow a caller's location, even if they're on the move. The next-gen 911 system will also let you send pictures, video to 911. What do you think about these capabilities? Would it be helpful? Have you ever called 911 in your community? How quickly have dispatchers responded to your emergency call? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jessica Jimenez and Molly Boss stay with us from the State Office of Emergency Communications. They're working on this next-gen system. Jessica, we have been talking about the text messages and the video capabilities, but what are some of the ways that NextGen would improve services?
So one of the ways that it would improve services is enhanced location information through geographic information systems or GIS. It allows for easier call routing. So if you're using a cellular device and you happen to bounce off of a tower site that is in the wrong jurisdiction, and it may be routed to the wrong 911 center, and so they have to transfer it to a different or to the right center. So in that instance, NextGen 911 gets the caller to the right 911 center, hopefully the first time around, and then if there is any instance where transfer is required, all of the data would be transferred with that call, whereas today it does not happen.
Oh, wow. So in the instances where there are cell phone calls, that call would be picked up and then transferred if it is bouncing off the wrong tower?
Yeah. So the way location works today, it typically centers on a tower site using the cell sectors within the tower that then could potentially be within 100 meters. It could be a couple of miles, which means that potentially you're going to the wrong 911 center if the tower site is set up to route to a specific 911 center. This happens across the nation, and I think something that NextGen 911 will hopefully address.
And, you know, time is so important in these instances. Even one transfer can, you know, can really make time add up.
Absolutely. I think with emergencies, we're talking about seconds sometimes. And so to avoid those transfers to begin with and then to not have to re-ask the caller their information and all of that saves those precious seconds that could really make the difference.
What about systems being overloaded and not being able to take calls? Could this next gen address that?
Yes. So the way that it's set up is all 911 centers that are interconnected with the system they have a specific interoperability that allows for those data transfers, and we'll be capable of interconnecting all of our 911 centers, which is not something we have today, depending on your service provider or those additional factors at the local level that just don't allow for those interconnections to happen.
So literally calls could roll over to a call center that wasn't overloaded.
Absolutely. That's part of the policies that go into the network and something that we'll have to work on as we start to implement NextGen 911 is those call routing policies. If a center is overloaded, those calls can potentially roll over into an adjacent 911 center. You know, obviously, we want to make sure that the calls that are being overflowed, the 911 center is capable of handling those. Obviously, we don't want Dane County's 911 calls to overflow into maybe Iowa or Greene County because they maybe only have two people to answer those calls that are coming in that would normally be to Dane.
Molly, if the system is more interconnected, does that make it more vulnerable to an attack, when you have this interconnectedness and, you know, even issues caused by human error?
I think anytime you're going to an IP-based system, the cybersecurity aspect is a lot more important. We're definitely ensuring that cybersecurity is a huge part of the ESINET, the statewide emergency services IP network that our state is, that our office is responsible for building out. We're ensuring that cybersecurity is a top priority. But yes, human error also can play into that, especially the cybersecurity part. But the way we are building the network, we are making sure that there is not one failure point. We are going to make sure it's redundant and that there isn't the possibility that the entire state could be knocked out at one time.
Yes, yeah, so some election officials often tell that their system is more protected against attacks or errors because it is not interconnected. So it seems that this system will have to be very sophisticated.
Sure. And we are working with obviously our boss, the Adjutant General for the state, is the Homeland Security Advisor for Wisconsin. So cybersecurity is a top priority for our department, our office, the state in general. We are working with other states, learning from some of the mistakes that they've made. Because our state is a little bit behind in the process, we're able to learn from mistakes that other states have made as well.
What other states are really out front here in NextGen?
Oh, that is a good question. Minnesota is a good example that we always tend to look at. They have built out an ESINET. It's interesting, though, because they're, from what I'm aware of, there's not a state in the U.S. that has fully deployed Next Generation 911. There are a lot of things that have to happen behind the scenes to have a full next-gen deployment. Building out the statewide ESINET is typically the first step, and I would say maybe half of the states in the U.S. have done that at this point.
We're discussing the state's plans for an upgraded network of 911 call centers, talking with Molly Boss from the Office of Emergency Communications, Jessica Jimenez as well. You can join the conversation. Are you a 911 dispatcher or a first responder? What do you think people should know about your work? Have you ever received busy signals or had trouble connecting? Call in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Jessica, what could happen if the next generation system isn't funded adequately in some communities? What if some communities can't make this work?
That's a very good question. I think from our perspective, it's a voluntary system, so we have to build it out to meet their needs, and whether they join the system is going to be up to those individual communities. But if we don't get everybody on board and we don't maybe have those centers that aren't able to make those upgrades, then we'll continue to have that siloed system. There'll be patchwork systems across the state where maybe they implement their own next-gen 911 system. So making sure there's still that interoperability between the systems will be a challenge I think we'll have to face.
But the challenge, too, is just getting everyone in. In the door, everyone operating together. And that really requires a lot of buy-in across the state.
Yes, and we hope that with a state-funded grant program or something along those lines, we'll be able to get all of our 911 centers up to where they need to be, and money won't be an issue for them to make that upgrade. It'll be more of an operational decision for them.
Molly, you said the state is seeking bids right now from vendors to build the next gen network. What is the status of that search?
We just recently put out a draft request for proposals, and we wanted to receive comments from the community to help improve that process. We are planning to put out the final RFP by the end of the year, and we're hoping to start implementation in 2020.
And how much is the state expecting to pay a vendor to complete this project, ballpark?
That is also a good question. We've been allocated $19.7 million by the legislature, so we are going to be using as much of that money as we need to, and then go back to the drawing board once we have a better idea about maintenance costs for the system.
Jessica, the state's new annual report on 911 system says legislative action may be needed to help the transition. In what ways? What might legislation look like?
Particular to, I think, a funding mechanism to allow 911 centers to make the upgrade, maintain their upgrades, and then when the equipment refresh cycle comes around, they're able to make those equipment refreshes as well. In particular, I think we need to take a look at the statutes and make sure that they're able to evolve with technology, not necessarily classifying a call as a voice call anymore. We're talking about all kinds of telecommunications devices that are capable of contacting 911, your tablets, your smartwatches potentially. So making sure that we're able to evolve with the technology and the statutes are there to not only be able to implement NextGen 911, but then looking beyond NextGen 911. We don't want to have to touch the statutes every time we want to make an upgrade. So making sure that they're flexible enough to allow for that.
Oh, because you have to bring the statute writing into, you know, the current 21st century.
Exactly.
And because we're, you know, going from this analog to this digital system. You know, as you go around the state, what is everyone's challenge out there? Are there some common things you hear again and again?
I think for 911 specifically, funding and staffing are two of the biggest issues. They're having it's basically a revolving door of telecommunicators and dispatchers right now. It's a high stress job that takes a lot of training, a lot of emotional capabilities that they're able to handle. I mean, you're hearing, you're now potentially going to have to see things that that they're not used to seeing. So making sure that people are trained to where they need to be, but then making it more of a professional service. You know, right now they're not classified as protected services the same way as law enforcement or fire EMS are. So making sure that the job is brought up to the level that it needs to be, because I feel like 911 is one of the most underappreciated emergency services out there. So,
Jessica, thank you for joining us.
Oh, of course, thank you.
And Molly, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Jessica Jimenez and Molly Boss, they're from the State Office of Emergency Communications in the Department of Military Affairs, where they're working on the state's next generation 911 program. Coming up, we find out about how kiosks work to test blood alcohol levels. Do you support electronic breathalyzer tests, or should this be left up to court officials? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll talk about the automated kiosks for alcohol screening after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're learning about automated kiosks for blood alcohol tests here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. At least 8 counties across Wisconsin are using these automated kiosks to do breathalyzer tests. They're the devices that test exhaled breath to indicate the amount of alcohol in the body or the blood. And these kiosks allow people to take the test without a supervisor. Sawyer County started using the kiosk almost 2 months ago. About 2 dozen people currently use it. Do you support electronic breathalyzer tests, or should this be done by people, not machines? Do you trust the accuracy? What about privacy here? We're at 800-642-1234. Diane McNamer is criminal justice coordinator for Sawyer County. She oversees the automated kiosk for court-mandated alcohol screenings. Diane, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate you having me.
So who is required to take regular blood alcohol level tests?
Well, our circuit court judge, based on the criminal complaint, will set a bond. And that bond, based on if it's an alcohol-based offense, such as someone charged with a possible OWI in the court, or maybe perhaps there is an alcohol-related offense that needs some monitoring, the judge will set that bond for either daily or random testing.
So are electronic tests, are they a reliable way to make sure people aren't reoffending, placing themselves and others, you know, at risk?
Oh, absolutely. I believe that the number one priority for anyone here in the system is community safety. And if you think about it, somewhat of a behavior modification. You have an individual that maybe is suffering with continuous use of alcohol. This may be in a way to test at a designated site. Most of them are located in a sheriff's department. So you come to the sheriff's department in that lobby. You submit your breath test. It is a calibrated breath test. It recalibrates after each test for each individual. And those results are sent electronically to myself or anyone else in who is using that kiosk to make sure that they have passed that test. So when someone is doing that, you're looking at almost trying to say, all right, you're having a charge. What are you going to do about it? The court can mandate the testing, but hopefully we're hoping that this would be a front-end opportunity for you to start seeking some counseling or other resources to avail yourself while your court case is pending.
So what does this kiosk look like? You know, we're stepping up to it now. What do we see?
When you step up to it, I would say it's approximately maybe 3.5 feet tall, maybe about 1.5 feet wide. It has a screen on that. And to get into the system, you actually do have to register with your name, a birth date, an actual identifying PIN number. And we walk you through that system. And the one unique identifying characteristic would be a fingerprint. And so after this initial registration, they're able to log in simply with that identifying fingerprint. There is a continuous camera that is capturing the test itself. That is a video camera that is running live for each test. That also is able to be seen by myself or whoever is monitoring it. And it's quite secure in the sense that, someone else isn't going to be able to do that test for yourself. You're able to, watch and see it is the individual that you are requiring to test is testing.
So what about all this personal information, like the fingerprint? Is that all stored in this particular kiosk machine?
Well, actually, the data is encrypted and stored in a cloud. So that means that storing the programs over the internet instead of on a computer's hard drive, no data is stored locally on the kiosk. And the kiosks don't store that fingerprint information, but rather it's an alphanumeric key developed from the information entered.
Well, let's look at convenience here for a moment. If someone is convicted in a county that is farther away to drive to do their testing, can these kiosks accommodate for that?
Actually, they can. It's quite possible that if you were, say, living or working in another county and you needed the ability to test in another county, that information can be sent directly to the county that is requiring it. So it's a great opportunity for someone who is, again, working out of county to be able to do that quick and easy, and it doesn't demand that someone has to test or require jail staff to take away from some of their other duties to find the time to do that. Again, many jail staff are doing multiple jobs, such as booking and so forth. So it's a time and a personnel issue that really is a cost saving to everyone.
We're talking with Diane McNamer. She's the criminal justice coordinator in Sawyer County, and she oversees their automated kiosk that conducts breathalyzer tests for court-mandated alcohol screenings. Have you ever been convicted of an OWI? Are you required to take an alcohol screening test? Would you prefer to do this with a person or at an automated kiosk? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Diane, I understand you personally administer these tests at the sheriff's office in addition to overseeing the new kiosk. How is this electronic test different than doing a test in front of a person?
Well, one of the things that is most unique is that I feel that the time saving is wonderful, and you're able to work within a 24-hour clock. So if somebody is working a third shift, for example, and we have individuals here that do work at a plant, that many times they get off at 3 o'clock in the morning. Now, you work in a county facility that really is operating from 8 to 4. That's very difficult to basically have people have to test in when their, you know, time to sleep is happening. Plus, how can you also work with individuals that have maybe some other conflicts within their life? You're able to give them, say, a two-hour window within to test. It speeds up the opportunity to do that. And when you have other multiple demands upon your job, it's difficult to always be where you need to be to accommodate everyone on a daily basis. As a small rural county, we are faced with not only alcohol issues in our county, but like many counties across the United States and in Wisconsin, we have quite the a drug epidemic that's going on. We are certainly using a lot more resources toward that. So this kiosk is giving us the insurance of a certainty of reliability. Plus, it's we understand it's certainly not a solution, but it's a simple tool to hopefully keep people accountable and help people make some changes within their lives to understand that I need to set more of a new boundaries or new normal for myself. It's amazing to see how after a long period of time with individuals testing, they now do have a new normal. They understand that they have to be sober, and they are testing that day, and each day is a new day to keep walking that path of sobriety.
What happens if they test and that data shows that they do have a blood alcohol concentration that is not in normal range? Is the data immediate, or what happens next?
Well, the data is immediate, and then that is going to require then a follow-up on our end through law enforcement or another positive verifying test. We certainly are going to look at that as somewhat of a waving of a flag saying this could be an issue. Please verify this, and then we'll take other steps. We are certainly not going to look at this as the only method and the veracity of the test as being completely valid. We will take other steps to do so. But again, it's a helpmate, if you would, to individuals and to secure, the community's safety. If you think about it, people with this is a nonviolent offense, and we are struggling with managing our jail bed days. Far better to have somebody going back in and supporting their family, re-entering back into the workforce, and having those boundaries upon them as their case goes through the court system, with not having to have somebody sit in jail, lose possibly their job, and actually sometimes mixing a low-risk offender with high-risk offenders has far more undesirable consequences in the long run than someone might expect.
Diane, I understand about 24 people are using the kiosk right now in Sawyer County for their monitoring. So when you see on your video camera someone stepping up and using the kiosk, do you stop your work to monitor them doing this? Or, I mean, how much attention does a person have to pay to this kiosk as they do their, you know, as they do their test?
Well, I have the test itself is going to take simply like under a minute. It's going to take them probably about 30 seconds to get through that test. But I'm giving notification immediately. And so if the notification will come up and it'll say a pass test for, you know, an individual, and I can look at that. If there was a notification to myself as a missed test, I will see that, and I have the ability to go back, review that at my discretion. It's captured. It's there. It will be there for as long as I need to go back on daily. You know, I could go back a week from now. I could look at it at 5 o'clock in the morning or at 5 p.m. It's going to give me that capability of having that captured test. But those results are given immediately to me, and I'm able to look at that throughout my daily work, which gives me a great deal of opportunity to and flexibility. Absolutely.
Talking with Diane McNamer, our guide from Sawyer County, where she's the criminal justice coordinator overseeing their kiosk. You can join in 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this conversation in just a moment. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about electronic testing kiosks for monitoring blood alcohol levels. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. These testing kiosks, they're popping up around the state. There will be more than a dozen counties using the automated system by the end of the year for court-mandated testing. And we're zooming in here on Sawyer County, which started using the kiosk in August. Two dozen people about with OWI offenses test at it. Do you think these breathalyzer tests should be automated like this or be done by court officials in person? What questions come to mind as more counties move in this direction with an automated device? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Diane McNamer stays with us. She oversees Sawyer County's kiosk as coordinator of criminal justice. Diane, let's talk about cost here. How much does it cost for someone to get tested?
Well, the actual costs are that the individual is self-funding this alcohol monitoring. So the cost can be set per county. Our hope is that we're able to not only provide that community-based testing service, but also that the individual is paying for this monitoring themselves. And in many counties throughout the state, if you're looking at a jail, deputy or a lieutenant to administer a test for an individual, there could be an out-of-pocket test. So this is no different in that regard. So the hope is that as we are just into our second month of testing here, that it will become income neutral to the county. Otherwise, the county was having to somehow absorb these costs, and difficult in today's times with the constraints on the budgets, et cetera.
Yeah, what are the upfront costs for a county to set up these machines?
Well, there's no actual startup cost for the jurisdiction of the county, and that's the beauty of that it's, again, self-funding, and that, if you can meet the amount of tests that would cover the cost. If not, then the county can pay that additional. If that comes to the point where there's so many individuals that are testing and there's beyond that that limit, then there is a, lack of another term, a kickback back to the county of 35% of whatever revenues are generated.
So considering the number of people who are taking the breathalyzer tests in Sawyer County, do you see that number growing to use the kiosk? Are you trying to move people in this direction for monitoring?
I believe we are, in the sense that I'm a one individual that's in charge of this, and there's 7 days in the week and 24 hours in a day. So to be able to accomplish this in an efficient way, I think that this is going to give us the most opportunity to not impact our jail staff, as well as make sure that we feel that we are doing the best that we can to manage those with an OWI charge, and also to look at freeing up jail staff or any other individual that their salary alone and their cost and their time would be far more prohibitive in the long run than having someone pay for the tests themselves.
I understand this is a Minnesota company that's in this kiosk business. I wonder, are all counties in Wisconsin that are using these kiosks right now, are they all going through the same company?
To my understanding, they are. I'm aware that there is 8 or 9 counties doing this. I don't know of a Wisconsin-based company at this point, but we're only a couple of hours from the Twin Cities. So ability to have that maintenance capability, or if there is anything that needs to be hand monitored or any changes and so forth, is really quite quick. We can have somebody up here within a few hours to help us if we have any needs on the unit itself.
We're talking with Diane McNamer. She's the criminal justice coordinator for Sawyer County, and she oversees these automated kiosks that are popping up around counties. She's overseeing the one in Sawyer County that conducts breathalyzer tests for court-mandated alcohol screenings. Diane, do you talk with other counties about this? Are they on the same page that this is working pretty seamless for them as it is in Sawyer County?
You know, I've had the opportunity to talk to a couple of counties, and many of them feel that this is really positive, freeing up that staff time, being able to focus on other duties, the ability to manage, the jail bed population more effectively, and also just about the reliance and also the total compliance that we are getting. I think that once you're able to work with somebody and their work schedule, which varies quite a bit up here due to the weather and also due to the seasonality of many of the jobs, this works quite well. Rather than having you must report between 8 and 9 in the morning, which many times interrupts somebody's work day and their schedule and taking off, I think that people are actually appreciative of the ability to have somebody help manage within their own personal schedules.
Are you saying right now you're seeing total compliance in these first couple months that you're using this kiosk?
I have not had any issues whatsoever. And again, our hope is that, and we heartily encourage, and many people do follow through in starting to get into their into AODA assessments and getting into many type of counseling and so forth. Again, this is a pre-sentence program that we're doing on this bond, and it seems to be working quite well for us. We've been doing bond testing for many years, and so looking back at to what we had to do and how many man hours were involved as opposed to this, it is truly night and day.
So this also requires the person to be taking their test publicly, in public, maybe people walking behind them as they come and go outside a door. Is there an issue with that, having this out in the open?
You know, I have not had anyone complain at this point. I understand, but that maybe somebody does feel uncomfortable, but it takes such a short period of time to do. But also, we have to have it at a place where there's going to be 24-hour access 7 days a week, and the Sheriff's Department is seemingly the best opportunity to do that, especially in a small county where opportunities like this are very limited.
Diane, if another county is thinking about adopting electronic breathalyzer kiosks, what advice would you give them, and any potential roadblocks that they should be aware of?
Well, I would say that that it's going to save time and money ultimately, and that's our overall, one of our overall goals. The other one is purely about making an accountability, making some boundaries or some parameters for individuals that are facing some difficult times ahead in the court system. I think that they're going to have the reliability. And one of the unique things about this system also is there is the ability to email send messages to these individuals. For example, it's going to be down for maintenance, or you now have done so well, you can test on every other day. All that kind of capability that people are now relying on their smartphones and so forth. I think we've transversed that barrier from into the 21st century as far as electronic data. And I think that is very helpful to many people. But again, I think it's stable. It's got a great capacity for many tests. It's reliable, and the compliance rate is wonderful. I would hardly recommend somebody at least investigating, see if it would meet their needs, and then find out by maybe talking to another county or watching firsthand how this process goes. I'm thoroughly on board, and I hope others will be as well.
Diane, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Diane McNamer is the Criminal Justice Coordinator for Sawyer County. She oversees her county's automated kiosk that we've been talking about for court-mandated blood alcohol level monitoring. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.